from the Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. 3 years ago, European governments were overwhelmed as a wave of more than a million migrants streamed across borders to seek a new life in Europe. That made immigration the biggest political issue in Europe and led to big electoral gains for far-right anti-immigrant parties in countries like Germany, Sweden, and Italy. But since 2015, the number of migrants arriving from Asia, the Middle East, and Africa has dropped by more than 80%. So far this year, there have been fewer than 100,000 arrivals, according to the International Organization for Migration. One major reason why is a series of agreements European leaders reached with gateway countries like Turkey, Libya, and Sudan to stop would-be asylum seekers long before they get anywhere near Europe's borders. These agreements effectively pushed Europe's border patrol duties outwards to other countries, and they've generated some controversy. On this edition of Global Journalist, we're going to take a look at how Europe has halted its influx of immigrants and what some of the hidden costs have been. And we've got a great lineup of guests coming up. To kick things off, we're going to look first at Sudan. Many of you may remember that country's President Omar al-Bashir is wanted by the International Criminal Court on charges of genocide and crimes against humanity in Darfur. But Sudan is now a key player in the EU's effort to stop immigrants from sub-Saharan Africa from coming to Europe. So to hear more, we're going to talk with the journalist Caitlin Chandler in Johannesburg. She's written for a number of publications, including The Nation and Dissent. She traveled to Sudan to investigate Sudan's role in helping halt migration to the European Union through a grant from the International Reporting Project. Caitlin, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us, Sudan has been an international pariah after the war in Darfur, and President al-Bashir was indicted for genocide by the International Criminal Court. How did this partnership between Bashir's government and the EU begin?
Well, it really began after the EU sought to curb migration even prior to what became known as the Syrian refugee crisis. So that occurred in 2015, but in 2014, the EU actually set up what was called the Khartoum process. And this brought together African leaders, including the president of Sudan and also Eritrea, both of whom are accused of crimes against humanity, and asked them to dialogue with the EU and essentially accept aid funding in exchange for controlling migration.
Well, You wrote an article for the news service Erin. In that article, you wrote that one of the outcomes of this partnership is that there has been this sort of informal agreement or assistance from the Janjaweed, these militias that were actually active in killing civilians and carrying out ethnic cleansing in Darfur 10, 15 years ago. How did this come to pass?
So essentially, the border between Sudan and Libya used to be relatively open. It was not patrolled by the Sudanese border police. But after the European Union began looking towards Sudan to limit the number of Africans crossing into Libya and then moving onwards to Italy, the Sudanese government deployed what they renamed the Rapid Support Forces, which does consist of former Janjaweed members, to the border, in part to turn back people who were trying to cross into Libya and move onwards to Italy. So although the European Union is not funding the Rapid Support Forces or the Sudanese government directly, the Sudanese government has publicly stated that they deployed this group to the border to help the European Union in their migration efforts.
Well, what does the EU say to allegations that it's sort of benefiting from this work by the Janjaweed, by al-Bashir's secret police?
They claim that they have no responsibility because they're not funding the Rapid Support Forces directly. However, they are pouring some $200 million into Sudan to international organizations, including security companies, such as a group called Civipool. And the result of all this money that's coming in is that some of it is going to train border guards, some of it is being spent on border equipment, and it's indirectly supporting the Sudanese government in their efforts. It also appears to have emboldened the Sudanese government to try to deliver for Europe on migration control in exchange for hoping to get access politically, to sort of get back in the game after they've been an international pariah for all these years.
So it certainly sounds like Sudan has something, you know, is looking to benefit in some ways here from this arrangement. But you traveled to Sudan and interviewed a number of refugees there. Give us just a sense as, I mean, it sounds like they're very vulnerable, especially the refugees coming from Eritrea through Sudan and trying to make it across the Sahara to Europe. Tell us just one or two of their stories.
So I visited a group of young women who are living on the outskirts of Khartoum. They were crammed into a tiny room. Some of them were teenagers, others were in their early 20s. They had all fled Eritrea for a variety of human rights issues and were hoping to move onward to Europe. But they were living in Khartoum in fear of the Sudanese police, who they say routinely stop them on the street, ask for their identification cards, extort them, sometimes try to sexually assault them. They had friends who had been arrested in the middle of the night from their homes. And what their stories illuminate is how, in the past 3 years, as this focus on migration control has started, the Sudanese government that has also started cracking down on people who previously lived in Khartoum without many issues. So prior to this, Eritreans didn't have these issues with the police, but now you see an increase in corruption, bribery, and abuse.
Well, did you get the sense, how easy is it to get from Sudan or Khartoum across the Sahara to the Mediterranean? Is it hard to find these sort of people smuggling networks that take people to the Libyan coast or to the Algerian coast?
It's not hard at all to connect with a smuggler in Khartoum. There's a huge thriving smuggling industry there. But it is becoming harder and harder to cross the border, in part because it's patrolled by the Rapid Support Forces, also because of conditions in Libya. I spoke with one Eritrean refugee who tried to cross into Libya, was intercepted near the border, and turned over to the Sudanese border guards. And he says that in his group of several hundred people, approximately 50 people passed away on the three-day journey from the border back to Dongola, which is a Sudanese town where they were detained, and then many of them were deported back to the countries they had fled from.
Well, our time does grow short, but what do we know about who operates these human smuggling sort of operations that leave from Sudan and are bringing so many people northwards?
What we know is that Human Rights Watch and other groups have documented the involvement of the Sudanese government at the highest level of some of these smuggling and trafficking rings. So many of the European Union's efforts to combat smuggling and trafficking through working with the Sudanese government appear to be very short-sighted and possibly dangerous.
Well, give us just a snapshot, if you would. What do you think this issue is going to look like a couple years from now? It looks like the European Union and the UN are investing more and more in Sudan. Is there some cause for optimism?
Unfortunately, I don't have much optimism. I think that the European Union is going to continue to try to increase the amount of funding going to this issue in Sudan and increase its involvement with law enforcement. They are involved in setting up a regional operations center in a police training compound in Khartoum, which is set to open this fall, reportedly to crack down on smuggling and trafficking networks. But I think we're only going to see an increase in millions of dollars going to waste without addressing the real root causes of why people migrate or making their journeys any safer.
Well, Caitlin Chandler, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. On today's program, we're looking at how Europe has slowed the massive influx of migrants to the continent over the past 3 years. We're now going to turn our attention to the Mediterranean, where Italy and its European allies have become much more aggressive in trying to stop migrants crossing by boat from Libya and elsewhere in North Africa. Now, this hasn't made much of an impact on reducing the number of migrants drowning trying to cross the sea. So far this year, 1,730 migrants have died in the Mediterranean trying to get to Europe. So to hear more about the situation in the Mediterranean, we're going to bring in Tim Harrison in Worcester, Mass. He's a nurse who worked for Doctors Without Borders earlier this year on the rescue ship Aquarius in the Mediterranean. Tim, welcome.
Good morning.
Well, talk to us just a little bit about this rescue ship that you were on. What was it equipped to do, and where did you patrol?
The Aquarius is a special ship which is uniquely equipped with a lot of desalinization capability. It's been operating as a search and rescue ship in the Mediterranean since the early part of 2016 as a collaborative effort between Doctors Without Borders, or Médecins Sans Frontières, and SOS Méditerranée, which is a Europe-based NGO, which is our specialists in search and rescue at sea.
And tell me, how often would you find people on the water in need of aid?
Yeah, invariably, every time out. So we would, we were based in Sicily for up until the late spring of this year, and we would make 3-week trips into the Central Med, and invariably we would find people in need of life-saving rescue. In the time that I was on board, and this is as I explained earlier, over the course of three separate assignments, 9 months, we rescued over 8,000 people. So it varied because the assets in the area varied as well.
Well, what are some of the challenges in trying to carry out a rescue of one of these migrant boats? Often they're really overloaded.
Yeah, they're not seaworthy vessels. They're by definition boats in distress. If you can imagine a 30-foot rubber boat with 150 people on board who can't move. They have very limited food and water, and they may spend hours and sometimes days in these boats. They break down, they take on water. They are most often not equipped with life vests. They have a small engine. You know, they're pushed off the coast of Libya with the promise of going to Italy. And they're really very dangerous, and you really have to be careful during the rescue. It's a very specific strategic rescue situation.
And what condition are the migrants in, generally speaking, when they're rescued?
Most of the people who are fleeing Libya have been in some form of captivity for periods of time, so they're not in good shape.
So these are people who have been kept in these detention camps in Libya, where many migrants that follow this route often end up before they can get to sea.
Not only the formal detention camps, which are government-run, but also captivity situations where smugglers, human traffickers keep people, extort them, the violence, the stories of violence and sexual violence, torture, etc., are just overwhelming when you have a chance to talk to people. So they're not in good shape physically.
Well, I mean, talk to us just a little bit about the status of these rescue ships. There has been pressure in Europe to stop these rescue operations from taking place. I think Italy's interior minister recently referred to them as sort of water taxis to help migrants get across the Mediterranean. Tell us just a little bit about that. Why are these unpopular with European governments? What would you say to them?
Well, the assets available in the Mediterranean are down to practically none. The Aquarius is the last independent vessel that's doing search and rescue at this time. It seems from our point of view, and we're simply performing life-saving capabilities, there's a picture of the Aquarius there. It seems to us that this is a systematic removal of witnessing in the area, and the capabilities for search and rescue are dwindling. And this is why you're seeing more deaths. Proportionately, in 2017, one of 42 migrants attempting to cross the Med died. And in 2018, that is three times as large. It's one in 18 at this point.
And, well, tell us, if you would, about your interactions with this organization called the Libyan Coast Guard, which operates off Libya, which has been trained and funded in part by the European Union and by Italy. They've come under some criticism for their treatment of migrants on the water.
From what we see, despite the fact that Italy and the European Union has poured incredible resources into the Libyan Coast Guard, and the Libyan Coast Guard is not a single entity, you know, the Libyan government only controls a very small part of Libya, but they don't perform professional rescues. They're often very aggressive. People are extremely afraid of them when they show up on scene. They know what's going to happen. The people who are in are trying to cross the Med, they know that the Libyan Coast Guard will be taking them back to Libya. So it's not really the Libyan Coast Guard rescuing people, it's intercepting them and taking them back to detention centers. They don't provide life vests, they require the rescued people to help with carrying dead bodies. They're immediately placed back into detention centers when they return to Libya. So they cause when they show up on scene, they cause panic and rescue people in panic in that situation.
Okay, so you've actually been in situations then when the Libyan Coast Guard arrived while you were carrying out a rescue then?
We have, and it's always really, you have to be very careful because the security of not only your ship, but also the security of the people. So it's very difficult. You may have to stand by and watch the Libyans intercept a boat rather than encourage the people in the rubber boat to, for example, go in the water and try to swim to your rescue ship. So you're required at times to stand back, maybe a kilometer or 2 kilometers away, and not be allowed to help intervene and bring the people to a port of safety. Libya will never be described as a port of safety. International law dictates that people rescued at sea from boats in distress are required to be taken to a port of safety.
Well, Tim, we're just about out of time here, but I think we're going to pick up on that issue in our next segment. So thank you so much for taking the time to join us. You're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about how Europe slowed the massive influx of migrants to the continent 3 years ago and what some of the consequences have been. If you're interested in more Global Journalists, check us out online at globaljournalist.org. There you can find our archives and additional coverage of underreported international news and human rights issues. You can also like us on Facebook, where we live stream, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, or see our videocast on YouTube. To broaden our discussion now, we're going to bring in two people who have been following both the politics and the policies of migration in Europe for some time. Joining us from Florence, Italy, is Andrew Geddes. He's professor of migration studies at the European University Institute in Florence. And with us from Bologna, Italy, is Michael Lee. He's a visiting professor of European studies at Johns Hopkins Bologna Institute for Policy Research. Welcome to both of you. Let me start with you, Michael Lee. We mentioned that this issue of immigration, it became kind of the number one political issue in much of Europe after this big wave of migrants began arriving a couple years ago. Now that these flows have sort of returned to what they were 4 or 5 years ago, is the issue becoming less hot politically?
If anything, it's become a hotter issue now than it was in 2015. We saw that in June, a summit meeting reached almost breaking point in Brussels when the new Italian Prime Minister promised to veto all other results of the summit unless Italy got its way on the migration question. So some observers think that today we're not facing so much a migration problem, although the issues are still there. As you said at the outset, there are still an appalling number of deaths in the Mediterranean. But overall, if there were the will to work together on these issues, probably it would be manageable at this point. So it looks rather, at this stage, it's a political crisis rather than a migration crisis.
And I guess, Andrew Geddes, my question for you is, to the extent that you agree with that, the question is why?
Well, I think that you've got to see this current situation with migration in the context of broader dynamics in European politics. So there's a migration refugee crisis that began in around 2015, which, as Michael said, has become a broader crisis of institutions and politics in Europe. But 10 years ago, there was a financial crisis which led to major effects on European society. So for many people in European countries, the migration crisis and has become wrapped up in a broader crisis of institutions and politics. Although one of the things that we've done a lot of work here at European University Institute looking at attitudes to migration, and one thing we should distinguish between our general attitudes to migration and, surprisingly, actually even during the crisis, they became more positive towards migrants, and the issue of salience. So for some people, migration is a big concern, and those people have been mobilized, but we shouldn't imagine there's a kind of tidal wave of anti-immigration sentiment sweeping across Europe. There's not evidence for that. It's the salience of the issue and the ability of certain politicians, such as Mr. Salvini here in Italy, to exploit that salience for the electoral benefit of his party.
Well, and Michael, if you could pick up on that, you also are in Italy, and we heard Andrew reference, I believe it's the Interior Minister, Matteo Salvini, who's been a hardliner on immigration. How visible is anti-immigrant sentiment where you are?
It is quite visible, even though in Bologna, in the north of Italy, one of the most prosperous regions of Europe, I cannot say that The health service, for example, or the education system is unable to cope with the number of immigrants. On the whole, it's coping rather well. But attitudes around here, anyway, at the anecdotal level, I haven't done a systematic study of the kind that Andrew was referring to, are nonetheless fairly sharp. You hear people saying things like, at last, we've got a government that doesn't only talk about immigration, it's actually doing something about it. And you hear this from even quite moderate people. So I think what has happened is that the whole issue has become highly politicized. The rise of movements like the Lega in Italy, or the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany, or the Swedish Democrats, or the National Rally in France, have pushed the mainstream parties themselves to take a stronger line on immigration than they would otherwise. And so, little by little, immigration has become a disproportionately large issue in the politics of Europe, to the point where you have declarations now that the EU could fall apart over the question of migration, just as a few years ago, people were saying the same things about the euro crisis. So indeed, the numbers are less alarming to Europeans than they were 3 years ago, but the political issue is just as intense as ever.
Well, Andrew Geddes, I guess we would be remiss if we didn't talk about the agreement that the European Union struck with Turkey a couple of years ago, under which Turkey effectively agreed to stop, especially migrants and asylum seekers coming from Syria to reaching the EU. How effective has that been in helping to resolve this issue?
It depends what you mean by effective, Jason. I mean, if you look at the numbers, they've fallen quite considerably. So in terms of the objective of the EU at the time of the crisis, which reduced the number of people arriving across the Mediterranean, those numbers have fallen dramatically. But there are a whole range of issues associated with the pushback effects. And so I think a lot of the dilemmas that we've already heard in this program are from the effects of a pushback of migrants to countries of origin and countries of transit. We heard about the situation in Sudan, in East Africa, but also, of course, there's serious developments in Libya that you were also referred to. So I think that, you know, the EU measures aren't dealing with the fundamental causes or drivers of migration. Those remain and remain quite powerful. But what the EU has been able to do through the Turkey agreement is push back. And to some extent, the problem is for a little bit kind of out of sight, out of mind.
And, you know, Michael, I mean, on some level, you can understand politically why this policy of trying to push back Europe's borders and the border enforcement into these transit countries, countries of origin, would be popular. The problem is kind of being hidden from your constituents in that way. Is that? But I mean, one of the solutions that has been talked about is for the EU to actually build, I guess, these migration centers in North Africa, in transit countries where would-be asylum seekers could be processed sort of closer to their home country. I mean, what are some of the challenges of that solution?
This came up at the European summit in June, in the middle of the night, by the way. Conclusions were finally reached around 4 a.m, under pressure from Italy. And really astonishingly, 28 heads of government reached conclusions calling for what they euphemistically titled disembarkation platforms in countries around the European Union, and voluntary controlled centers, quote unquote, inside the EU. But in fact, they had never checked with any of these countries if they were willing to establish such so-called platforms. And it's turned out in the 3 months since then that none of them were consulted and none of them are ready to do so. So at the end of the Salzburg summit meeting just a couple of days ago, the president of the council, Donald Tusk, announced that there would be a series of consultations with Egypt, various African countries, and the Arab League to see whether any of them would be willing to cooperate in this type of initiative or other initiatives to control migration flows. If I may be allowed a brief comment, I think it's astonishing that in a very short period, the pendulum has swung from EU policies towards these countries that were very largely based on promoting good governance and respect for human rights and so on, to a policy that now places migration and the control of migration at the very heart of the EU's relations with these countries. Something of a blind eye turned to the human rights issues that previously were the main focus of our attention. And I think this is something we have to be very careful about.
Well, Andrew, if you could pick up on that point as well. I also wanted to ask you if there are some analogies here. Obviously, immigration is a huge issue in the United States as well. Is there something that U.S. policymakers can take away from Europe's experience in sort of trying to push this problem back into transit or host countries?
I mean, the one thing we should bear in mind is that European and US policymakers have been talking to each other for years. So they've been sharing experiences, sharing ideas. This solution of kind of, or the search for a solution which involves pushback, or as Michael referred to, this kind of what's called regional disembarkation. Actually, we can trace origins of that to Australia, but then Australia, in its geographical setting, has been able to identify offshore locations where it can process and detain people. That Europe doesn't really allow that kind of, you know, it's not possible to find countries that are willing to take that kind of take those kind of measures. I think both the US and North America have found themselves in a situation where the consequences of pushback can be quite severe for the neighbouring states. As Michael said, the change in the nature of relationships in the Mediterranean is very significant in the European Union over the last 20 years. And I think that's also an issue associated with efforts of border control in North America as well. So there are analogies, and policymakers in Europe and North America talk to each other a lot and share ideas and experiences, and have been doing so for a long time.
You're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about how Europe slowed the massive influx of migrants to the continent 3 years ago and what some of the consequences have been. If you're interested in more Global Journalist, check us out online at globaljournalist.org. There you can find our archives and additional coverage of underreported international news and human rights issues. You can also like us on Facebook, where we live stream, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, or see our videocast on YouTube. Michael, we're just about out of time. You have about 30 seconds here. Are you optimistic that there is going to be some of these issues are going to be addressed over the next couple of years in a positive way?
Some issues will be addressed. For example, changing the rules about how asylum applications are assessed, doing that more effectively, more quickly. One can see signs of progress here and there, cooperation among European coast guards. But one does not see a really coordinated approach that's likely to produce a more coherent European policy on the subject overall. That has yet to emerge.
Well, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Caitlin Chandler, Tim Harrison, Andrew Geddes, and Michael Lee. Our assistant producers this week are Grace Lett and Shirley Tay. Our supervising producer is Yanqi Xu. Aaron Hay is audio engineer. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.